Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
So I learned this week that back in 1919, my wife's great-grandfather, Clint Witt from Francisville, Indiana, got in a fight with a guy over the repair of his car. The other guy is charged with assault and provoking an assault. Great-grandpa was charged with assault and battery, which means basically the other guy started it, but great-grandpa finished it. $18 fine. Don't you love digitized newspapers? Hey, welcome back, Genies. It is Extreme Genes, Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. I'm your radio root sleuth, Fisher, and that kind of stuff is what the show is all about, stories about ancestors and how to find them. And today, Stan Lindis, our research authority from HeritageConsulting.com, joins us again with some more tips on how to dig up the dirt the old-fashioned way, finding real documents and books, not the virtual kind, the kind that you can touch and hold and in libraries and archives, and how to make the most out of your trip. And this is really good stuff if you're planning to visit one of those places soon. Stan joins us in about 10 minutes. Last week, we talked with ProGenealogist.com's Gordon Remington about the Mayflower passengers, the differences between pilgrims and Puritans, why you might suspect you're a Mayflower descendant, and great sources for finding and proving those lines. So, of course, we asked you in our poll at ExtremeGenes.com, are you a descendant of one or more passengers on the Mayflower? And the answer came back 72% yes. Now, I doubt it could possibly be that high for the entire audience, but for those who answered the survey, well, I'm sure Mayflower descendants who know who they are more likely to hop aboard and give us a yes. So thanks for playing. Our new poll is up, and we'll tell you all about it in a few minutes. Now, from sources all over the world, here's your family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeGenes.com. We start with a story from Johannesburg, South Africa. There's been a bunch of tombstone thefts from cemeteries all over the place there. It seems that slimy stonemasons have created a black market for thieves to bring them granite or marble gravestones for reuse. And the thieves, of course, work the graveyard shift, if you know what I'm saying. And they're taking about 20 stones a month from 36 public cemeteries. So a company has come up with an idea, a solution, offering families microchips that can be slipped into their loved one's stone. Now, if the stone is disturbed, an alarm will be sounded and a text message will be sent to the family cell phones. Now, wouldn't you just love to be the one, by the way, catching these creeps? Johannesburg already allows people to place microchips into their loved ones' actual graves because cemeteries there are in wide open grassy places, and it helps them to locate the grave whether or not it has an actual marker. So this is a logical solution to a growing problem. They call this system the Memorial Alert, and it was created by a private firm in South Africa. The creator says the transmitter chip is not visible or easily accessed, so that if anyone messes with it, a number of things can happen, including an alarm that goes off right there in the cemetery. Security companies then also get the alert that the family receives, and they say actual tracking devices would decrease the battery life and would dramatically increase the cost of the service, so that's not being offered at the moment. Of course, with all that they do offer, they don't think thieves would risk getting caught in their escape by trying to lug a heavy tombstone off the ground, so it's not likely the tracker will ever become necessary. The prices haven't yet been set for these chips, but the service begins in January, and by the way, they say tombstone theft is a worldwide problem, so you may see the service being offered here before too long. You can read all about it at ExtremeGenes.com. You know, they say often that you don't know how history is going to view you till, well, after your history. Take, for example, the case of the Patriot News in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Now, they're still around, and they've been around for a long time. Back in 1863, they were there when President Lincoln offered his Gettysburg Address. Now, that was 150 years ago this past week. Wow, it seems like yesterday. How did they feel about the president's comments? Words for the ages? No, they covered the story and gushed about the Secretary of State and his lengthy oratory. But as far as Lincoln was concerned, here's what they had to say. We pass over the silly remarks of the president. For the credit of the nation, we are willing that the wall of oblivion shall be dropped over them and that they shall no more be repeated or thought of. Well, last week, the heirs to the throne of the Patriot News took a giant step back from those comments. The editors wrote, 70 years ago, the forefathers of this media institution brought forth to its audience a judgment so flawed, so tainted by hubris, so lacking in the perspective history would, that it cannot remain unaddressed in our archives. And then they write, in the fullness of time, we have come to a different conclusion. The world will little note nor long remember our emendation of this institution's record, but we must do as conscience demands. In the editorial about President Abraham Lincoln's speech delivered November 19, 1863 in Gettysburg, the Patriot Union failed to recognize its momentous importance, timeless eloquence, and lasting significance. The Patriot News regrets the error. Apparently, the deal was back in the 1860s, the Patriot was what was called a copperhead newspaper. They were very supportive of the Democrat Party, of which Mr. Lincoln, of course, was not a member. The year before, several top editors had been arrested and thrown in jail by Union troops accusing them of sedition. So you got to imagine this tainted their view somewhat. And I'm thinking the apology is better late than never, and is certainly a well-thought-out way to create worldwide attention for the newspaper, conscience or not. Next up from the pages of ExtremeJeans.com, a recent tornado in Washington, Illinois, did what tornadoes do, destroyed property and a lot of it, as well as a lot of memories. Documents and photo albums were strewn everywhere, even as far as 60 miles away, where Becky Siegel Hardy makes her home in Seneca, Illinois. Well, it was just a matter of hours after the devastation that Becky's husband stumbled onto a receipt in the driveway. It was from a Walgreens in Washington. And as a result of that, Becky and her two boys started looking for lost items from the tornado that found their way to her neighborhood. Well, from this, Becky started a special Facebook page to help people from all over Illinois scan and share photos, mementos, and documents that they found wherever that they knew belonged to people in the devastated area. In just a few hours, hundreds of people were sharing scans of what they had found. They now have over 1,000 followers, with hundreds of photos being posted that had been picked up connected to the tornado. The New York Times has a great story out on the return of a Revolutionary War cannon, 257 years old, that has been returned to its rightful owners, Saratoga National Historical Park. Now, this cannon is one of only three like it left in existence, a six-pounder, meaning it can fire six-pound cannonballs. It was made in Britain and taken off to Canada, where General John Burgoyne put it to use against our colonists in 1777 in the battles in and around Saratoga, New York. Well, fortunately for us, Burgoyne lost, and the Americans got the cannon, which they then used against the British in battles that followed. Now, nobody really knows just how it happened, but back in the early 60s, about 1961, it disappeared. Whether it was forgotten or taken or loaned, whatever, nobody seems to know. But Saratoga National Historical Park needed to replace its missing cannon, so one was loaned to them by the Rutherford B. Hayes Center in Ohio. Then back in 09, a ranger in Saratoga learned from a tourist in Alabama that he had seen a similar cannon down in Tuscaloosa. Well, that, of course, led to an investigation. And what they found was that their cannon was now on display at the Tuscaloosa Museum of Art. Well, of course, the Alabamans didn't want to give it up. And then the question was, could the people in Saratoga prove that it was their cannon? So the people in Saratoga went to work putting together a treasure trove of like 68 pages of documentation concerning the cannon that they had had up until about 1961. Some of the material came from the British archives. And, of course, all of that proved what the Saratoga folks knew all along. It was their cannon. Extensive negotiations began, and in time the Alabamans caved, sending it back to where it rightfully belonged in upstate New York. It got there on August 29th. And it was supposed to be rededicated on October 5th, but there was that pesky little government shutdown that delayed their plans, and so the ceremony only took place 9 days ago. So here's what they know about this very nicely maintained cannon. It was cast in 1756 near London. General Burgoyne and his troops hauled it south from Canada in 1777 to try to take the area around Albany, New York, and effectively split the colonies, which they hoped would and the Revolution. It was one of 18 six-pounders in Burgoyne's possession, while our side didn't have a single cannon. It's bronze, 5 feet in length, shot six-pound cannonballs, as well as grape shot, which is deadly in combat. They weren't considered heavy artillery, but were still highly effective in battle and could more easily be moved. The Times article mentions that a soldier's body was found at Saratoga in the 40s that contained the grape shot that no doubt claimed his life. The cannon was later used for defending the coast by our side in the War of 1812. It was at one time displayed in Brooklyn about 100 years ago at Prospect Park at the site of the Battle of Long Island. So it was later decided then it should be more properly displayed upstate, which is how it wound up back in Saratoga, at least until the mysterious events around 1961. What happened after that is unclear. It apparently wound up in an amusement park near Saratoga, then to some collectors in Connecticut and Florida before showing up in Alabama in the 70s. And it remained there for about, 35 years, but now is back in Saratoga. There's something to take a look at, obviously, if you're ever visiting the site where perhaps your ancestors fought in upstate New York. Another mystery solved. And coming up next, Stan Lindis with some really good information on maximizing your time and increasing your chances of success on your next research trip on Extreme Genes. Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, you found us, Extreme Genes, Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, and welcome back, Stan Lindis.
It is great to be back.
He is our research authority here on the show, and, you know, off the air during the break here, we were just talking about, you know, what a troublemaker you were in a library. Where was this?
Oh, it was Jefferson City, Missouri. It wasn't okay. Me.
Yeah, no,
my mentor.
Yeah, but it was you by association. So
you're saying I got thrown out as well as he did.
Yeah, well, if you hung out with a guy who's causing trouble, then you're a troublemaker.
Yeah.
So you were on a research trip in Missouri.
We were actually on a research trip throughout most of the Midwest, going from Utah back to Indiana and Ohio and Illinois and back to Missouri, down into Kansas and
where
Oklahoma.
Didn't you go?
I didn't make it to Schenectady. But at any rate, and now the fellow that I was traveling with at the time, I can use his name. He's long gone, deceased, now on microfilm.
Right. Okay.
His name was George Nixon. He was a fabulous researcher. He was my mentor when I first started in the business 37 years ago. At any rate, he had business that he had to do. Find records in the state archives in Missouri at Jefferson City. And we go, and first of all, you struggle to find a place to park. Always plan ahead to know how far you're going to have to walk or how much it's going to cost you to park.
How long?
Especially major metropolitan areas. Not that Jefferson City is a major metropolitan area.
That's right.
But we go in.
And Barney Fife would come, hey there!
Pretty
much. Park now.
Pretty much. We go in, and within 5 minutes, George has made the acquaintance of the chief archivist, who was instrumental in acquiring things out of a special collection.
Right.
Well, their personalities clashed.
How do you clash with somebody in that situation? For Pete's sake, you're both researchers. You share the same interests. You understand the behavior patterns within these institutions.
I was there, and I cannot tell you.
Yeah, see?
I think it was just first impressions, the look, something. At any rate.
But they rubbed each other the wrong way.
Yeah, and George said a few things that, George was a former sailor.
Oh, boy. I don't know a lot of former sailors who become researchers. That seems very different.
It seems dichotomous, I know. At any rate, so he offended the archivist, and the archivist promptly threw us out.
Yeah, you with
We had
him.
Only driven 500 miles out of the way.
Oh.
Yeah, because guilt by association.
Right, and see, the parking didn't matter at that point.
No, at that point, it really didn't.
Kind of passed. Well, and this kind of leads us to what we wanted to talk about a little bit today, because, so many of us, who are starting research now maybe have never even been into a library or some kind of a research facility because so much is done online, and thank goodness for it.
Yes.
But there's still a ton of stuff in these institutions to check out. Let's talk about that.
Well, back to your comment about so much is online. Many people, even seasoned researchers, get caught in the trap of believing if it's not found online, I can't find it.
Yeah,
it's not searchable.
Sure.
Well, that's not so. I mean, with the plethora of records that have been put up by Ancestry.com, Find My Past in England, Family Search, you know, there's a ton there, but there's much, much more out in the real world.
Right.
And at some point, when you quit finding things online, you need to utilize the resources that are available. And these would be repositories, libraries, archives, genealogical societies, historical societies.
And can I mention, too, it is a lot of fun to go someplace and find a book on a shelf.
Yes.
And thumb through it and find something. You're making a face here.
If it were only on a shelf.
Right.
We were on another research trip. My family and I, we were traveling back to Illinois from whence I come. And my wife's family was from Seward County, Nebraska, or Seward, the town of Seward,
okay,
which is a county seat just north of Lincoln. And so I'm insistent that we're going to stop here.
Right.
And we have a van full of kids. And so I leave my wife with the kids out in the town square while I go into the courthouse to look for a marriage record for her family from back in 1875, I believe it was. And so I go in, and this is one thing you can expect in rural areas. You won't find this in a large city. You won't have the accommodations that they grant you in rural areas. But I walked in, and I said, I want to look for this marriage record. Well, sir, the marriage records are in the vault upstairs. Okay, fine. So can somebody get those for me? No, but you're welcome to go up and look for yourself. And so I go up into this massive vault. Oh, there was a qualification for my going up and searching.
Uh-oh.
And that was that when I finished, I made sure I closed the door. This vault had a window facing west, and the sun shined through it. And the reason I had to close the door is because the judge was growing a rubber tree plant, and it was in that vault because it was hot and humid and steamy. And the thing was clear up to the 12-foot ceiling, bent over, coming back down and going back up again. Well, nothing was in order. It was all in cardboard boxes,
okay,
Fish. Just jumbled papers.
But and that's fun, too.
Oh, yeah. I was waiting, slogging through these things. I found the record I was looking for. My wife, to whom the family belonged, was not a happy camper being out on the town square at 90 degrees, 90% humidity.
Wondering where you are.
Why am I not getting back down here and getting in the air-conditioned van with the kids that are now exhausted and gravy.
Yes.
But at any rate, the point of this is be prepared for anything when you go to these places. Make arrangements beforehand if you can. It will really, really enhance the chances of your success. Establish a relationship with the archivist or the librarian or the resident genealogical guru.
Well, that really applies to anybody. Cemetery people.
Oh, yes.
You know,
by all
no
means.
Questions. I went to New York back in September to do research. And called ahead on all of them. And it made a huge difference.
Yes.
I arrived. I gave them my name, gave them my ID. They gave me the rules, you know, about, you know, what you can take pictures of, what you can't, what can you carry a pen or a pencil or whatever. And then they presented me with the documents I already knew I wanted. And I was sitting down looking through the stuff within 5 minutes of my arrival.
Right.
Which
Your
was
time
wonderful.
Is so critical.
Yes, on a trip.
And when you go to these places, or in a library, a research library, or even just a local public library, you can spend all day trying to figure out where stuff is, or you can swallow your pride and go up to the counter and ask.
This is like men asking directions on trips.
Exactly.
It really
exactly.
is. You know,
or reading the instructions on the microfilm reader or whatever machine that it is. It's not the American way, but they do put them up there for decoration.
Well, and on a trip like this, like you say, the time thing is so important.
Now, the other thing, one other thing you might want to consider is this, is that when you go into a library, especially a library, that before you go, look online and see what they have in their catalog. Many of the libraries nowadays have their catalogs up online, so you can go and see what there is.
I did this with the Brooklyn Historical Society.
Yes.
And that's why it was so easy.
Yes.
It was a boom there. They didn't have to, and it was a week ahead of time, so they had plenty of time to do it.
Yes. And in addition to that, when you get into the library or before you even go, and because you're establishing this rapport with a librarian, basically you're sucking up.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you are.
And it's okay. It's okay.
Right.
We don't mind. They will never see you again.
Turn on the charm.
That's right.
They will do things for you that you never imagined.
And they will tell you what kind of research aids they have developed in their library, i.e. like at the Salt Lake Mormon Family History Library. They have research guides and resources for helping you to slog through gigantic collections, which can save you tons of time. Your chances of being successful are greatly enhanced by knowing not only what the holdings are of the library, but what the system is for taking and making shortcuts.
You know, it's helpful, too, if you're going to do something, say, you know, we're talking about the LDS Family History Library
yes.
in Salt Lake City. If you find out who might be on the floor when you're there, who speaks the language that
That's
you
right.
are researching.
That's right.
And that has made a big difference for me. And, you know, if I was
yes.
making an appointment, to know that somebody was going to be there who could translate something. And they have a lot of helps all the
oh,
way
heaven
with
just.
That. With,
oh, heaven
you know,
just.
Here's the word for baptized, or here's the word for birth or death or burial.
Which might be critical for you to know when you're doing your own research.
Well, especially with languages that look like a third grade art student made these
yes.
Notes. Yeah.
Yeah, the things that you and I can't recognize
right.
because there are 37 consonants in it.
Yes.
Yes.
That exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Other things that you might want to think about are, and you kind of alluded to it there a minute ago, about going into a repository and knowing what you can take in with you, i.e. a pencil or a pen
right.
or a piece of paper. There are places that you go that you cannot take anything in, and if you want something copied, you're not the one who gets to copy it. So you need to know what the rules are.
Yeah,
the home
they made me
is.
Check my jacket at some places.
Yes.
That I could not be wearing a jacket. I couldn't bring in a backpack or a briefcase or anything like that. Those had to be checked in. So basically, you know, you go out and you're on your own.
Yeah, and a great example of this would be, and most people wouldn't even think about this, is the VA,
the
Veterans Administration.
Okay.
If you have an ancestor who was in the military, there may be a VA file for them. And you can fax a request to the local VA office for that file, and you can go in and look at it. But you can't take anything to write with in with you, and you have to use some yellow stickies or something to mark the pages you want. They copy it. They mail it to
you. Exactly.
Now, there's a way around this so that you don't have to try to remember everything you saw. You can always call yourself and leave a message saying, John Smith, born here, died there.
That's
children.
Great tip. Yes.
So just call yourself and leave a message.
And I went through this with some Civil War ancestors, looked it up, but the guy actually, you know, brought out the original files, which
right.
were amazing to me. And then he sat across from the desk from me while we looked at them.
Right.
But he wouldn't leave, you know, so because they don't want people pilfering
right.
it. I get
That's
that.
Right.
And I'm appreciative of that because I don't want my records to be, you know, going with somebody else who's going to pilfer it.
Right.
So, you know, that's great advice.
The bottom line here is make preparations, make contact, create a friend. Then when you go, you've got an ally. You're not stealing time from them. A lot of times they're just thrilled to meet you. And the period of time that you're going to be there isn't going to allow them to know you well enough not to like you, unless you do a George. But, you know, make preparations.
Unless you're just an annoying person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I can be, depending on what hamburger I didn't eat.
Right.
You know, so.
I understand.
But it's critical to your research to be able to have an ally in the repository, and you're going to come away with a whole lot more material than if you don't have one.
He's Stan Lindis from heritageconsulting.com. He is our research authority on the show, and we're going to come back here in just a couple of moments and talk about some exciting new software that is coming out, and I can't wait to hear what you have to say, Stan. Coming up next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Your radio root sleuth Fisher here with Stan Lindis from HeritageConsulting.com. He is our research authority. And you wanted to wrap something up there about the archives and the libraries.
Yes, yes. When we go to archives and libraries,
yeah.
We are setting or laying the groundwork for others who will come after.
That's true.
and it is imperative that we treat the archivists and the facility with great respect, be able to thank them profusely when you're done, offer to give them assistance in something.
Sure.
And you can do this over the phone, too. I mean, you can call these archivists and talk to or a librarian.
You can drop a note. You can send them an email. There's so many ways to do
that. Always offer to help them if you have the ability to
do it. This is like cleaning up the golf course after you make a little divot. You know, people are going to be behind you.
Exactly.
You want to make sure you don't leave a mess, because inevitably there's one incident that causes some very unfortunate policy to go into effect.
Yeah, which will eventually come back to bite you.
Yeah, at some point. You're absolutely right. So, Stan, tell us about this new software. You were sharing a little with me off air, and this is very exciting stuff.
Yes. Even if you're not familiar with Mocavo, they are still doing it.
Okay.
But if you're familiar with them, you may want to go and look at their website, Mocavo.com. And this is a site wherein it's a subscription site.
Okay.
But they have multiple databases, and you can search each one, or you can buy a package and be able to search across all of them at one time.
All right. What kind of databases do they have?
Oh, vital records, histories, the normal genealogical databases.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are duplicates of other sources that you have out there. But one of the exciting things that they are doing, and we all have benefited on the computer with the ability for somebody to film and digitize records and then have them indexed, whether it be manual indexing or OCR, optical recognition,
programs. Yeah, that's right. You have the program that the character recognition.
Exactly. Typed characters.
Yes, of course.
And we've probably all had occasion where it wasn't typed and the system tried to read it and you got gobbledygook or what the software thought it was. Well, Mocavo has been developing some software that will be able to read handwriting.
Oh,
and differentiate.
Shut up. Really?
No, quite seriously. I mean, it's mind blowing because your handwriting and my handwriting are not exactly the same. Heavens, my handwriting is not the same it was 5 years ago.
Sure.
Okay, so there are changes. And
hold on. I'm trying to get my brain wrapped around that right now. And it's like, how does it work? Have you heard an explanation?
Well, no, they haven't finished that portion. But one of the critical elements in this is that if you look at old documents, let's say a Civil War pension file document,
right?
There is a form, and it was typed in some font,
right,
or another. And some of the fonts even look like cursive handwriting.
Sure, the S's that look like F's.
Yeah, any variation on the theme. But the typewriter that they had at the time, or the typeset that they had, was standard. And the program development thus far that Mocavo has is that they have got it so that it will be able to distinguish between handwriting and a font, which is imperative when they are doing their scans and trying to figure out who's who in the zoo, if you will.
Sure.
I can't even begin to imagine.
But then it can recognize the handwriting itself.
Yes. It identifies handwriting as handwriting and typed material as typed material, which is amazing in and of itself. But they are on their way to now developing software that can recognize what the handwriting is. And they've even had occasion that the system has been able to read something that the human eye was not able to decipher.
Oh, my gosh. That's exciting.
We've all come
stuff.
Across that where you
yeah,
look at something.
The document that's unreadable.
Yes.
I had an ancestor, a third grade, in New York City, who had testified in one of the Anneke Jans trials.
Yes.
And I had contacted the archivist who was in charge of that record, and he found the record. He found the testimony with the guy's signature at the bottom. Very cool. And he sent me a copy of it. He said, "There is no charge because this is illegible."
Right.
He said, "Nobody can read this, so it's of no value to you. Therefore, it's of no value to us. Here you go." I was able to decipher it. I was able to read ultimately, but I have to put it in a book with, here's the original, and
yes,
here's what
tell
it
them
says.
What it says. Yes. Know, the transcription
ridiculous.
Next to it.
Isn't
so,
that
yes.
funny to think, though, that a software could come along and say, all right, we know what this person's saying. And I would imagine it's going to be like it has been with the type stuff at this point, because even typewritten stuff is not perfectly.
No.
The character
no.
recognition is not perfect. There will be errors.
There's but, that when you and I look at it.
Right.
When the most powerful instrument you have, your hopefully your brain.
You would think.
Yeah.
Not in my case, but yeah.
But when we have trouble trying to decipher something, you know, to think that some software can do pretty much what we are
at
doing.
At least as well as we would. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And
yeah,
in
that
some
would be great.
In some cases better.
Hopefully.
Because the optics that they have to be able to lift an image or enhance an image that you and I can't do, you know. You and I, well, unless you're a superhero, I suppose, you can't look at something with an infrared eyeball and be able
sure.
to see where the pen strokes were.
Now I'm thinking, you know, this would cover stuff like wills. Because
wills.
So many wills have been done, you know, they're all handwritten. What else? I mean,
land records, law, you know, things in courthouses,
right?
Church Bible records,
a lot of church records. Yep.
Letters from, you know, Aunt Sue to
letters.
Yes.
War letters.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. War letters.
Wouldn't that be fun if this software became available where we could put in our own handwritten stuff that say came down? I've got a whole treasure trove of my grandparents' letters. She came yeah. from Sweden, and so English is her second language, and her writing and the words, not so good, you know, but to have, you know, to just feed it in and have somebody else, because I transcribe 50 pages of what these letters said in some kind of order as best I could, but boy, to be able to feed it, that would be worth its weight in gold to me.
To be able to feed it into a system,
yes,
even if it's not your material or my material, imagine right now the things that are being indexed
yes.
and made available online. The index is just being made available online.
Millions of things every day.
If the exponential growth of that by being able to
sure.
index handwritten records
yeah.
is just incredible. I mean, I remember sitting in the library doing research 37 years ago, and we'd get excited when a new typed census index
yeah.
came out for a specific county.
That's right.
Okay?
Yeah.
As opposed to what we have now, where things have been digitized and indexed by individuals
and imagine
through Ancestry
where we are
or whoever.
Five
yes.
years from now?
Yes.
I mean,
no,
it's
I can't
just
imagine.
Insane. So let's go through this real quick because we are going to run out of time. The name of the site is?
Mocavo.com.
Okay. And they are coming out with the software to at least recognize the difference now between handwriting and typewriting.
They are developing it. It's not ready to be
okay. But it's
put
coming.
Out there. Yes.
What's
coming.
The timeline do we think on
I
this?
Have no idea.
Okay.
I just read the press release this morning. And so,
oh, okay.
Yeah,
so this is new news.
This is
you heard it
new.
First on Extreme Genes Family History Radio.
Unless you got the email from Mocavo.
Unless you got the email from Mocavo. So.
Sorry, Fish. I...
ah, drat. Stan Lindis, always good to see you, buddy.
You too.
Welcome back. He's from heritageconsulting.com. He is our research authority, and look forward to having you back soon.
I'm thrilled to be back. Thanks, Fish.
And coming up next, it's Tom Perry, our preservation authority from tmcplace.com. He's going to be telling you about video camcorders. If you're thinking about picking one up as a gift for the holidays or some such, he's going to tell you not only the price is what you want to look at, but some other things as well. He's got it for you next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, welcome back. It's Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth with Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. Welcome back, Tom.
Good to be here.
I was out there looking around at some of the electronic stores, and there are so many camcorders that are out there, different sizes, different types, HD. How does one know what to get, especially if you're thinking of, you know, family history and preservation?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things to consider. A lot of people just think, you know, the more expensive it is, the better it is. That's not always the case. You need to kind of figure out what you want, what your goals are, you know, what your budget is. But some people just buy the most expensive stuff. We have people bring in constantly high-definition camcorders that have a hard drive built-in. They want them transferred to DVD in standard definition so they can watch them. So why go and spend, you know, $3,000 on a killer camcorder
right?
if you're never going to really want to watch HD stuff? So basically, you need to sit down and figure out what you're really going to want to do, not what you dream of. Don't buy, you know, Dodge 350 when a 150 is going to take care of you. You know, just be really smart. But there's a lot of different kinds that are out there. And the biggest thing that I want to warn people about, don't go into like a Walmart or a Kmart or a Sam's Club and look at their stuff and think that's all there is. They always have the newest technology, but that doesn't mean it's the best technology.
For your purpose.
Exactly.
Especially. Yeah.
Do the research. Go online. Do stuff. A great resource tool on the internet is you can go to bhphoto.com, as in boy, hairy, photo.com, bhphoto.com. It's an outfit out of New York, and they are the premier. They have one of the best, most user-friendly websites I've ever seen. You can go in and look at HD camcorders, SD camcorders. You can look at, you know, high-def stuff. You can look at ones that take MDVs, ones that have hard drives built in, all kinds of stuff. And you can spend from hundreds to, you know, $30,000 if you want to. But it's all in one place on one site, and so it's easy to look at it. They have clickables where you can read all the specs on it. You can actually look at the owner's manuals. You can compare prices and stuff. And whether you buy it from them or not, that's totally up to you. But do your research there. And if you still have questions, either email me at asktom@tmcplace.com or call them, you know, ask them. They have a real good sales staff. But they have everything. They don't have just the newest stuff that's come out. Personally, when people come into my store and talk to me, what do I need to do? If you're just going to be casually shooting stuff, your daughter's recitals, your son's football games, I would prefer to go with ones that still have the tapes. And everybody goes, what tapes? That's old technology.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I would have never imagined.
Oh, yeah. The MDV tape is still the best way to go. You can go high def with it or you can go standard def with it.
Huh.
The nice thing about it, you know, let me tell you a little story. We have people constantly, at least once a week, they come running into our store saying, oh, my daughter's recital is in an hour from now. My hard drive's full. Can you download all my stuff from my hard drive onto DVDs or Blu-ray so I can go and shoot this? And, well, how much footage you have? Well, I have, let's see, 12 hours, and her recital is in 1 hour. You know,
that isn't going to happen.
No. It'd be cheaper to go buy a new camera.
Right.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But that's what's nice about these tapes. They're still digital. They're awesome. Pop out a tape, pop in a new tape, pop out a tape. If a tape gets damaged, bring it in, and we can usually fix the tape and recover the rest of it. If you have a hard disk camera and you damage it, drop it, and break it, it's toast. It's unrecoverable.
So, I think you hit on it right there, what most people think, that tape isn't digital.
Exactly.
But tape is digital.
Oh, absolutely.
And like you say, it's much easier to handle. And especially at the end of the day, who keeps the tapes as a whole and looks at them as a whole like we did back in the day with the old home movies? You take them, you digitize them, you edit them, and you keep them. So as long as you're going to be editing them anyway and putting them on some kind of drive at some point, what's the difference whether it's put on a tape or something else?
Oh, yeah. You plug your camera in FireWire, and you're not going to have anything. It's going to be totally lossless, so it'll be easy to edit it. If you don't want to deal with that, you only want little components, bring it into us or send it into us. We can make you DVDs. You can take the DVDs and edit down. And the quality does go down a little bit, but it's so insignificant, most of our customers never notice the difference. You can get a program called Cinematize from like Newegg.com, and it's like about $50 for their basic version. You can take almost any kind of a DVD, turn it into an MOV file or an AVI file, and then edit it. And the neat thing is you don't have to render the whole DVD. If there's a five-minute segment that you want off this two-hour DVD, you can just render that 1 5-minute. But that's what I like about tape. Tapes can be fixed. You can always find tapes almost any place you go, but you're not
cheaper too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, when we first did tapes, they were $10, and they came down to $5. We sell them in our store for $3 for an MDV tape.
I would have never imagined.
And another thing, since you brought it up, don't reuse your tapes. They're so cheap. Take it, put it on the shelf, take it, put it on the shelf. People do multiple passes on tapes, and every time you do that, again, like we've talked about before, it's like writing on a piece of paper with pencil and then erasing it, writing on the same paper again, erasing it. Pretty soon you're going to have a hole in your paper. And that's how the tapes are. The tapes are so cheap. Shoot it, put it away, shoot it, put it away, just so you've got it. And it's a good way, a good backup. So if you have the DVDs at home, give grandma in another state all your tapes to store them for you.
Wow. That's why you're the preservation authority. Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. Tom, as people look to perhaps preserve their old home movies and videos for the holiday season, you've got a great reference site at TMCPlace.com.
Oh, yeah. Just go to TMCPlace.com, and you can click on it. It says 24/7 information, or you can go to shop.TMCPlace.com, and you can go in and find estimates on anything you're looking for. And if you want to do your own transfers, you have your own equipment, you can too. But there's a whole bunch of pages that show you ways to figure out formulas, how big of a hard drive you're going to need, what kind of compression ratio you're going to use, all these kind of things. So use this as a resource. If you bring your stuff into us or send stuff into us, that's fine. If you want to do it yourself, there's still a lot of resources. Whether you live in Dothan, Alabama, or you know Paris, France, we're there to help you at any time, 24/7.
What else do you have for us this week, Tom?
Okay, the several formats that we're talking about with camcorders, you have what's called Mini DV. It stands for Mini Digital Video. It comes on tape. Don't confuse it with Mini DVD, which are the little teeny discs, which if somebody gave them to me for free, I wouldn't use a camera. We have people that have gone to Disneyland that shot a whole week's worth of stuff. They get back home. They can't finalize their disc. So they have to bring it into us with their camera. We have to transfer it. And sometimes it can be done. We've actually had ones that we've tried. We couldn't even get the content off them. So stay away from the mini disc cameras. I don't even know if they still sell them. If they do, stay away from them. In professional formats, they have big disc cameras that are awesome, but they're $30,000. So we're not going to afford stuff like that. The other format, you have the HDD camcorders, which has a built-in hard drive. And those can also be standard definition or high definition. And a lot of people now are going to SD cards, which are little teeny plastic things, which are great. They're convenient, like the hard drives. You can download your stuff really quick. However, at least once a week, we have people bring one in. It was in their pocket. It got squished. It got wet. If you record on those, make sure it's nothing really, really important, and you get them transferred to your computer ASAP before something else happens to them. So you want to make sure you stay away from the mini DVDs. I recommend going to mini DV because of the convenience, the easy to use. They're great digital cameras. Then also look, do you need high definition? They're going to cost more, but it's great. But if you're never going to need it, you don't have any HD information to you know watch on your TV and stuff, there's no reason to go to that kind of expense. So kind of look at your budget. And as we mentioned earlier, you can go to www.bhphoto.com, as in boyharryphoto.com, and do all kinds of research on their site, and then either buy it through them, buy it local. But don't go to Walmart or Sam's Club and think that everything you see there is the latest and the best. The latest is not always the best.
Interesting stuff, as always. Thanks for joining us, Tom. Talk to you next week.
Good to be here.
Hey, that's it for this week. Thanks so much to Stan Lindis from HeritageConsulting.com, our research authority, Tom Perry, of course, and to you for joining us. And just a reminder, of course, there's probably some episodes of this show that you have not listened to, and there's a lot of great information in there, a lot of fun. Also, make sure you check out our podcasts at extremejeans.com. They're all waiting for you right there, and share them with a friend. Get on our Facebook page. We'd love to have you there, and we'll talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. It's a Fisher Voice Works production. This has been Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel. Brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.